then we had our first military coup in November, the 11th of November, 1958, Shaka.
Yes,
So it is the first military coup on the African continent.
you are right.
Yes.
Maybe there's a distinction between Africa and Black Africa.
Well, I'm sorry. That's the problem that we need to deal with. And to my mind, the OAU should have started on the right footing by dealing with socio-cultural issues
I
before going into political issues.
I think you are right, because Africa historically has in fact been partitioned in three different parts. You talk about Africa south of the Sahara. You talk about
Yes.
Africa, essentially north of Limpopo. You talk about North Africa, talking about Maghreb,
Yes,
Yeah,
yes,
I think we need to get a way of simply looking at Africa as Africa. Now, let me
yes.
ask you, Temi. The ambassador is talking about democracy, and indeed, democracy is probably the solution for most of Africa. Any particular reason why, for example, a lot of African leaders who run democratically challenged countries discredit the concept of democracy to the extent that, in fact, they ask their people if in fact they can eat democracy, that it is better for them, for example, to provide them with what they call service delivery and not necessarily democracy. How do you react to that?
I think, like you said, the leaders who are meant to be leading democratic nations, but they're staying in power for way too long, many years past their terms. They're changing constitutions, and some acting undemocratically in nature. I think this is because of this business as usual approach that goes on the continent. So it's more beneficial to these leaders to stay in power and to not have the peaceful transitions that they're meant to, because it's more beneficial to them. It's more beneficial to the people around them that they are doing nepotism with. So it's definitely a huge issue on the continent. We're seeing this kind of new generation of leaders who, strong men who don't want to leave their positions. We just saw this in Uganda with Museveni. Bobi Wine, was meant to be this hopeful young candidate who many people who had the popular mandate that many people wanted to be in power, but unfortunately, he what they weren't able to make that transition. So. I think one of the main reasons is the shrinking of civil society space on the continent, is why democracy isn't allowed to freely flow the way it needs to. And I think the US definitely needs to hold a lot of these nations more accountable with their policy towards them. So say we're not going to give you military aid, threaten the ending of development aid as well if if they don't abide by democratic rules the way they're meant to.
Is democracy and service delivery mutually exclusive, or are they in fact mutually reinforcing?
I think that democracy should just be the default for countries. I don't think there should be any asterisks or requirements for it beyond that. This is just we're following our constitution and democracy is the default for our society. So shady deals, different things that are incentivizing leaders to follow democratic ideals, that shouldn't be what's normalized. What's normalized should be the default of being democracy, the status quo being democracy, and peaceful transition to power.
What about you, Ambassador Noureddine?
I have answered that. They, in the streets, even with the current difficulties, economic difficulties, and livelihood difficulties, when they go to the streets, they say in Arabic, "Ajur, ajur, walel kezan." They say hunger, hunger, rather than going back to the former regime of the Muslim Brotherhood. So they prefer to be hungry with freedom rather than to have the, you know, their delivery services satisfied, which were not satisfied anyway before that. So the answer is dignity and freedom and human rights are very important. For me, it's not a kind of binary, you know, thing, you know, question whether this or that. The question for me is, how are we going to achieve delivery service within a democratic regime? And that's exactly what we are grappling with. That's most of our countries are grappling with. This is often used as an alibi to say, yes, stable regimes are better than democratic regimes, which is a fallacy to me. Now in Sudan, what we are saying, let us create a stable democratic regime that can deliver services to the people. And that's the formula in which we are working now. We do not ask ourselves whether it's better to have food without democracy, or to have democracy without food, or to have stability and all that. It is for us now to work together in order to see to it that delivery service delivery. And actually, yesterday there was a meeting in Khartoum at the top level on delivery service and how we deliver services to the people while continuing with our democratic agenda.
You can in fact have both, just like the Americans say, you can walk while at the same time chewing gum.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Interesting. Tell me, former U.S. President Barack Obama would seem, in fact, to agree with Ambassador Nuruddin, because he once said that even prosperity without freedoms is in itself a form of fundamental poverty.
Of course, I think the lack of freedom of speech, freedom of voice, and freedom to move as you want in a state, these are all, you know, important elements. And if you're not given them, but, you know, maybe your economic is prospering, or prosperous rather, you know, it's not a happy life for the people. You know, when you look at happiness and you know what it, you know what it means to live like a fulfilling life, you have to have, it has to have multiple aspects. It's not just economics, it's democratic freedom as well.
Interesting. Nuruddin, how do you respond to some supporters of the strong man syndrome, who say that if you have a regime that stays in power for a long time, like your former president, Omar al-Bashir, stayed for about 3 decades, that in fact implies and should reflect, in their words, not mine, what they call peace and stability?
I beg to disagree, because the 30 years of al-Bashir regime have not given peace and stability to Sudan. They have given war and conflict and poverty. This is fallacious. It is not true that the mere fact that a ruler stays for 30 years, this will automatically, cause peace and stability for the country. At least from our own experience in Sudan, this has not been the case. We, on the contrary, the more a strong ruler stays in power, the more complicated become the problems of the country, become intractable. The issue of peace of Sudan has been complicated. The issue of unity has been complicated. The issue of diversity has been complicated. The issue of welfare has been complicated. You take all the boxes that you can think of, you can see that they have not been ticked in the proper manner.
Tell me, is it reasonably possible to talk about peace and stability without the presence of social justice for all?
Yeah, I think that's a very important question, whether it's possible to have peace and stability without social justice. I don't think so. I think we've had a lot of case studies throughout the world where, even in the past year, where we're seeing social justice issues being risen up, being brought up by the people. And because of this, there is this lack of peace and stability in this country because the people aren't happy. And as a result, they go to the streets, they protest, they make demands. So you can't really say your nation is peaceful or stable if there are these issues relating to social justice and human rights that the people are not happy about. There is going to be this feeling of being unsettled in the nation. We've had numerous case studies and examples of this, throughout history. And like I said, in the past year, even with the Black Lives Matter movement we've seen in the United States, there is this sense of instability in the country, tension between different races and things like that. And that's because there are a lot of social justice issues that need to be rectified. And if we go to the continent as well, we can see this as well. You know, NSARS in Nigeria, Zimbabwe, and their protests that they had as well. So I think, definitely social justice has to be a number one priority. Listening to civil society voices has to be a number one priority if you want to have a productive society.
Nuruddin, what are some of the important lessons that other African countries can learn from your experience, especially when we talk about social justice? You look at the geographical location where the Republic of Sudan is located. In that general neighborhood, there's no one country that can boast on providing its people social justice.
Well, of course, social justice in our situation has been a long-standing dream and claim of the people. But unfortunately, our political class has not delivered on that since independence. And to my mind, and as Tim was just saying, social justice is at the core of the question of governance. A government that does not take care of the social justice and providing social justice and social services to its people, even if it stays for decades and decades, at the end of the day, the result will be total failure. So what are we talking about? We are talking about the people being satisfied that they are living in a free country, in a free society, that they are allowed to speak their mind and express their views, that their dignity is being respected, that the as a people together, they have a common goal to achieve, that together they look at for a brighter future for them and for their children, and that they are able to bring food to the table. So that all this together, and that, of course, those who feel that they have been marginalized for so long feel that they have their rightful place in the society, in the institutions of governance. And this brings me to the issue of institutions and strong leaders and all that. Rather than talking about the necessity of having a strong leader that stays forever, I think the most important thing is to build strong institutions that can withstand the pressures of time and the pressures of all the centrifugal forces that are trying to destabilize the country. So if you are able to build those institutions, then with the agreement of the people, and especially with those who have been marginalized for so long and who claim their rightful place at the table, and then you will be assured that you have nothing to fear, and that you can call on the people and depend on the people to defend the institutions.
Institutions, strong institutions indeed. Tell me, to what extent do most Africans understand or know their relationship with the thing called the state or the government? Do most Africans really know their relationship with their governments?
So I think that's another very important question. I think the relationship between many African citizens and their governments is strained, and that's because of, you know, years of oppression, strongman politics, and all those things tie into institutionalism and systemic, you know, laws and things that are in place that are very difficult to move. So a lot of citizens have a sense of voter apathy, a sense of just overall apathy that no matter what, their vote or their demands, what they want, isn't going to make a difference because there have been decades and generation long of, like I said, systems that have been in place that have not recognized them. So the way they see their relationship is very strained. It's not, you know, in a way of, oh, I can go to my government and say I have this issue and, you know, it will be resolved. It's one of just, you know, feeling neglected and feeling like there's this loss of hope.
Ambassador, what about you? To what extent are the vast majority of Africans citizens or subjects? And in fact, what is the difference, in as far as you are concerned, between a subject and a citizen?
Yeah, well, I think there is a disconnect between the states and their citizens, as far as I'm concerned. And this has been going on for a very long time. And that's why, personally, I've always seen the governance issue as being an educational issue. You need to educate the people.
Civic
about
society?
What as a society
are you
need to
about
educate
civic
education, of course.
Yes,
and that's why Muallimu in Tanzania is called Muallimu, which means the educator. So we need educators in you know, at the helm of the state. The modern state has not yet found its place in many parts of our countries. If I take the Sudan as example, there is a disconnect between the modern state and between the traditional state, which is still living its own life. And in many parts of the country, still traditional governance has to be taken in consideration if you have to, do you want to deliver anything? So this is another aspect. But the question about citizens and rulers, a citizen is a sovereign person, mm-hmm. who has full rights of citizenship, mm-hmm. Full rights of contributing to the major decisions, to choosing his or her own government and those who are going to govern her. And those who are being chosen will be answerable and accountable to that sovereign citizen. While as a ruler or a subject is someone who is dictated upon in terms of livelihoods, in terms of values, in terms of views, in terms of ideas, in terms of choices, in terms of how that person sees him or herself and sees other people. So there is a big difference between the two, and that's exactly what we are dealing with in our African countries now.
And what sort of person did the Sudanese transitional government find in the place in the context of Sudan when they toppled the former president, Omar al-Bashir?
They found a subject, of course. They found us a subject. And that's what the revolution in Sudan is all about, Shaka. It's about bringing, you know, full citizenship to Sudan and full rights of the people.
Tell me, this must be encouraging news from the new Sudanese authorities, because a citizen is the person that owes allegiance to the state. And for that, the citizen has a constitutional right. He is the primary stakeholder. He is the boss. Whereas a subject owes allegiance to an individual authority, who could be a king, a queen, a monarch, an emperor, or a presidential monarch. How do we resolve this issue? How can we solve this contradiction?
Yeah, you know, my last response was very pessimistic, you know, discussing, you know, the loss of hope, but case studies and examples like Sudan does give us hope. You know, it shows that if the people come together and have a revolution and stick to their demands as well, because the Sudanese people were very strong in what they wanted, and they refused to stop protesting and leave the ground until, you know, their requests were truly met and not haphazardly. They wanted the full thing done, you know. So revolutions is definitely one mechanism for receiving or creating change. Another, I think, is, you know, the youth and women. You know, in Sudan, women were the backbone of the movement, you know, and they have a way of going about things that has been very inspiring in a lot of movements throughout the world. So I think listening to women is very, very important. And, you know, Africa has the largest youth population in the world. So the youth are truly the future. They have, you know, Gen Zs, millennials have new, fresh ideas for, you know, how the world should be operated. They definitely think differently than, you know, the older generation as well. So I think, you know, listening to these people who are really the stakeholders, the youth are the ones that, you know, we're creating the world for them. So, you know, listening to what they think is important, and also educating them, bringing them into political spaces. You know, I think all of those things are very helpful in helping to shift the issues that we're seeing on the continent when it comes to, you know, democracy, social justice issues, etc.
The changing demographics, indeed, I might add, in tandem with the social media.
Exactly. Social media is another I was also going to mention. You know, a lot of these revolutions have taken place or started, you know, even the Arab Spring. I think the Arab Spring was a beautiful example that's helped to inspire, you know, protests and revolutions that we've seen since then. It shows the power to mobilize online and then come to the streets. And I think when done in tandem, you can see really amazing results.
On that note, Ambassador Nuruddin Sati and Temi, I have to say once again that it was a pleasure to host you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Bye. Sir.
Thanks to our audience for joining our conversation on Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, please, let's keep the African hopes alive.